Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's the real oldest profession in the world, herding hooved animals for sustenance. And it's a way of life that began for author Brad Kessler with four goats in a Vermont chicken coop. In herding, breeding, birthing, milking, making cheese, Kessler found a very earthy path to the sublime, the goat path. This hour on Point, a short history of herding and life with goats. You can join the conversation. Do you know the life? Birthing kids and goat cheese for breakfast. Have we forgotten the history? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. And let's get the sound right here of Nubians, the kind of goats that Brad Kessler kept and keeps, known as the most vocal of goats. Here's a little sample from the barnyard. Sounds like Stella, Stella. There they are in all the glory. Joining me now in the studio is Brad Kessler, author of the new book, and it is a wonderful book, Goat Song, A Seasonal Life, A Short History of Herding, and the Art of Making Cheese. Brad Kessler, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is just a terrific, terrific piece of work. You put me in the mind of Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek way, way back when, and then I turn back to the beginning and see you've actually dedicated it to her. Also put me in the mind of childhood. I grew up raising, not goats, but sheep, but it's mm-hmm. they're close cousins. We'll talk about it.
Right.
What put you on a Vermont farm rustling up goats?
Well, we moved to Vermont about 10 years ago, and we were always interested in raising our own food. And we did raise a large garden that we ate out of and canned and froze our vegetables. And one day my wife came home after milking a neighbor's goat with a bottle of fresh, warm goat milk. And I tried my hand at making a cheese. First, it was a queso blanco, which is, you know, the simplest cheese in the world. Mm. But with just vinegar and heat, and you have a cheese. The next time the neighbor went away and my wife came back with a bottle of goat milk, I tried my hand at a chèvre. And when we ate it, it was astonishing. I mean, there was nothing as fresh or creamy that we'd ever had before, and it felt like we were eating not a cheese but a meadow. You could taste the herbs that the goats were eating the day before, and we decided to get our goats. I mean, there was no going back after that. We became sort of addicts.
And off you went. You started with just two. They're Nubians. Those are big, beautiful. Describe a Nubian for us. I mean, these are large, ultimately, animals. These are 100, 150-pound does.
Right, up to 200 pounds mm-hmm. and more. Most people have this image of goats as being these sort of scrawny,
little, mm-hmm.
white, the nanny and Billy from childhood,
yes.
Licking tin cans.
Yeah.
Not true. These are kind of airbrushed brown and black and spotted.
And tawny, and, beautiful colors.
Yeah, gold and bronze and striped. And they have long dangling ears, mm. white ears.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ever see them with long dangling ears. And what they describe as Roman noses, which mm-hmm. I've never seen a Roman with a nose like that.
But it is what we describe as Roman. It's kind of a prominent, I mean, it's definitely
yeah.
a nose. It's noble or whatever you want to
right,
call it. It's a
nose.
Mm-hmm.
And and they're large goats. The woman that we bought them from, who taught us a lot of the husbandry, raised these goats in particular for their size. They were long and leggy. She called them ladylike.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first saw them, we just sort of fell in love with them because they were these beautiful creatures that one usually doesn't associate with the storybook image of goats.
You're a New York kid, though that's long ago. You've walked a lot of trails since then. But I did have this image of you picking up these goats in the back of your Saab. I know
right.
that's very Vermont, nevertheless, an old Saab maybe. But that's so sort of particular in its non-huge herd way
exactly.
of beginning. But very soon you're into it, and you feel the magic of it, and we get the magic of it right away in your book, Goat Song. I wish you'd read just from the top so our listeners can begin to get a sense of how the sort of the history and the holy and the poetry and the pasture all pile in here.
Okay. This is the beginning of the book. Early June, the mountains turn tender green this time of year. The skies become enamel blue. The goats wear bells around their necks while we hike up Mason's Hill. There's eight of us here today, seven goats, one human. We step through salad greens, and the goats taste everything in sight. Steeplebush, wild strawberries, buttercups, blackberry vines. We're heading to the mountain soon. Each day we wander the Vermont woods for an hour or two. I love the leave-taking, the sound of the goats' bells, the brief nomadism. Herding is a way of doing something while doing nothing. It asks only for one's presence, awake, watching animals and earth. Wind rakes the trees, clouds float shadows through the grass. We enter the woods and the goats eat ash, birch, and maple. This evening I'll milk the does back in the barn, and when the sun goes down I'll make an aged cheese from their milk called a tome. Months from now, when snow covers the mountains, I'll open that tome and find this day again inside its rind, the aromatic grass, the leaves, this wind. I call the goats on. They moan back from the branches. Hannah and Lizzie, Pi and Nisa, Penny, Eustace, and Alice. I know each voice as well as any humans. We're heading up the slope now. They nod through cinnamon ferns.
Brad Kessler reading from his new book, Goat Song, A Seasonal Life, A Short History of Herding, The Art of Making Cheese. You are, and it is clear, a writer, your wife in this enterprise with you, a photographer, and you come at this from just about every angle. I mean, you say it's the story of your first years with dairy goats. It's a story of what it's like to live with animals who directly feed you. It's a story of cheese and culture and agriculture. But you say it's also a story of the rediscovery of a pastoral life. Rediscovery, why?
Most of us here in the West come from, so many of our traditions come from pastoral roots, everything from our diet to our elements of our alphabet to our economy to our religions come out of the pastoralist milieu, which goes back about 10,000 years ago during the Neolithic when we first domesticated animals and then from the cultures that developed from them. So the first few days with the goats or the first few months, it felt sort of atavistic, like it was something remembered. And
like you'd been there before, even if it was 2,000 years ago.
Really. Yeah, there was this continuity. And I had always loved pastoral poetry without knowing why it was called pastoral poetry until I started keeping goats and writing this book.
And in their lives, in the rhythm of interaction with them, you end up finding something almost holy. I mean, you're writing that it makes perfect sense to you suddenly why, shepherds announce that Jesus is born in Moses, right, and Joseph and David and Amos and Krishna, and for that matter, Muhammad. Here's the words of God in the wilderness. No man becomes a prophet, he wrote later, who was not first a shepherd.
Right. Yeah, there is this wonderful history of herders that were prophets. And partially because, and I sort of wondered why that was the case, and partially because they span this world between the human and the animal, between the wild and the domestic, the place where you would herd sheep and goats, or not in the town, we're not in the cities, but off on the margins. So they had this little window into an older way of being, their days were spent watching the air, watching the weather, mm-hmm. watching the animal, watching the non-human world. And so it became this thing that I was kind of fascinated in. Why were all these prophets, shepherds, and herders of animals?
We'll wend our way back there. You start off with the back seat of the old Saab laid down, lined with a tarp, a broken bale of hay in there. How did you actually get started? You brought these two goats home and?
Right. Well, we got two goats. There were two adults and we had two kids. Mm-hmm. So we started with four. Mm-hmm. And we relied on our neighbors who raise goats for a lot of our instructions. So the first thing we needed to do was fence in a big field, mm-hmm. and we had to build a barn or improve a barn or a chicken coop, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then we bred them. I mean, that's what you have to do to get milk, which is people forget.
To get the does started lactating. It doesn't happen just out of nowhere.
Right, which is something that it's like something you learn in school about why the sky is blue. And we tell people were asking, well, when are you going to get milk from your goats?
Yeah.
And we said, well, we have to actually breed them first and they have to have a baby first mm. for them
what?
To produce
You're
milk.
Kidding.
And then they kind of, the look is always beautiful to see on people's faces because they scratch their head for a minute and they said, oh, of course, that's how milk comes.
Right.
And we have this image of cows just, you know, they come along and they just produce
Here's the milk.
Right. So we had to breed them. And 5 months later, the gestation period's 5 months, and they have kids, and then we have milk.
And we steal the milk.
And we steal the milk.
From the kid.
Yeah.
One way or another. And you've got a wonderful description of how and why. We're going to go right back through all this. I mean, your description of the breeding is something to behold. That's the most explicit sex I've read in many a year.
Well, the goats, there's nothing as perverse as goat sex.
Right. And then the birthing, which I know well from my own childhood, the long nights waiting, hoping they come out just right, having to push back in and pull out again if they don't, and all the rest. And onto cheese. We have cheese sitting right here on the table. We're going to come to it later in this hour, and its aroma is gently filling this studio right now. Take us to the end a little bit. Have you still got the goats?
Oh, yes, of course.
How many now?
We have 9 goats, 9 adults, and we had 8 kids about a month ago. Most of those are gone, and we're actually licensed to sell cheese now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life with goats, with a writer who packed it in, moved to Vermont, and became a goat herd and cheesemaker. Brad Kessler is with us. His new book, Goat Song, is a beautiful meditation on the pastoral life and the ancient roots of rising with the sun and living with goats. Brad Kessler is with me in the studio. He's got a couple of cheeses right off his Vermont acreage that we will slice into before this hour is out. And we're happy to have you as well. We've got a lot of people enthusiastic about goats and herding. From New York City, Liz. Liz, you're on the air with Brad Kessler.
Hi, Brad and Tom. So nice to be on your show.
Yeah.
I am also a native New Yorker, and I found myself living with goats in the High Atlas Mountains of Morocco as a Peace Corps volunteer a few years ago. And, boy, the sounds of goats at the top of the hour put a huge smile on my face. I woke up to them every morning for a while. We spent 2 summers living with the shepherds way high up in the mountains where they bring the goats for the summer to graze. Mm-hmm. And we lived in tents, and we studied the ancient tribal laws that govern grazing, and lived with goats. And my question to you is, what about the cows? Goats were fine. I loved them. They were amazing. But it's the cows that I fell in love with.
Everybody's got their species. How about it, Brad?
Well, there's a saying in where I live that there are 3 types of people. I mean, the goat people are people that love the animal. They just fall in love with the antics and the characteristics of the goat. And then there are sheep people who like landscape, the idea of sheep sort of inhabiting a landscape. And there are cow people, and the cow people tend to like heavy equipment.
Right.
So it's you know, it could
they're
be a
big,
cow.
They're brawny. They're big economy scale.
Yes, big scale. It almost doesn't matter which was the particular ruminant that one falls in love with. And in my case, it was, the goats are the oldest domesticated animal after the dog. So we share this astonishing cultural history with them that goes back, to the Neolithic. And they accompanied us out of Homo sapiens out of the Near East and Africa when we went on our migration sort of into Europe and Asia. So they were our pioneering animal. I mean, the cow entered the picture thousands of years later, which is might be one reason why people who are lactose intolerant can still, some people this is, can still drink goat's milk and as opposed to, cow's milk that we haven't figured out the kinks yet with cows.
And your goats, above all, Nubians, as you write, the loudest of the domestic goat breeds, the cry of a goat is so haunting and dramatic, you write, Brad Kessler, our word tragedy comes from it. Tragoidia in Greek, the cry of the goat song.
Right.
Title of your book. I forget who it was. You quote somebody in here talking about the peculiar or particular intimacy of life with just this kind of animal. Give us the rhythm of a day herding, raising, husbanding goats, and how that intimacy comes. I know it from childhood, but you write it wonderfully.
Yeah. Well, the goats live, they don't live very far from our house. The barn is very close. So in summer, we only milk seasonally. Mm-hmm. So we have the luxury of being farmers from about May 1st to October 15th. And once when the leaves are on the trees, we're milking. When the leaves are off the trees, we stop. And we stop making cheese and things settle down and we could become the artists that we are again. My wife, Donna McAdams, who's a photographer, mm-hmm. and I'm a writer. So during the summer, when we're you know, milking and making cheese, you know, we wake up at dawn, and usually there's a goat staring from the field into our window. I mean, you know, we're on the second floor, but you look out the window, and they're waiting for us to come out with the milk pail. And one of us milks, and that takes, you know, an hour or so mm-hmm. To milk for. We're only milking four goats now. Sometimes we're up to seven milkers. And so we spend time with them in the morning, and usually around noon, I mean around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we take them for a walk in the woods because the browse is really good for them, and it's really good for the cheese. And
turns out
so
good
much
for you.
And it's good for me, yeah. It's, you know, it's our miniature transhumans. This caller from New York just talked about how they took the goats up to the mountains mm-hmm. in the summer, and that's called, technically, it's called transhumance, mm-hmm. which it's practiced throughout the world, and it's where you bring your animals, your domesticated animals, up to the high pastures where there's lots of food for them.
And it's what took shepherds or goat herds historically out away from society, up often into communion with even God.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, the life up on the mountains. And this is something that happens in the Hindu Kush. It happens in mm-hmm. South America. It happened in the Scottish Highlands. It was universal. This transhumance of bringing animals up in the winter, I mean, up in the summer and down back to the farms in winter. And interestingly, it usually separated the men from the women. Some cultures, the men went up and the women stayed back. In other cultures, the women went up and the men stayed back.
You quote E.O. Wilson, the famous biologist, saying, "Every species of animal opens the gates to the paradisical world." Give us a sense in the sort of daily interaction with your small flock, how and when and where in the rhythm, when in the interaction, when, I don't know, when your head's against their side, mm-hmm. when you're milking, how did right. that open for you?
Well, the book is in some ways this exploration of this idea of that E.O. Wilson quote, which is if you look closely at any animal species, whether it's a goat or an ant, they sort of reveal their secrets, their esoteric life, which reveals sort of all life in general. If you study something through the lens of a microscope or through a camera, so when you live intimately with animals that directly feed you, when the milk that you're eating and maybe the meat that you're eating comes from something that you know that you have this intimacy with, we begin to remember what I think we all once knew, which is that we're part of the earth and we're part of the land and what sustains us. So this idea of paradise, well,
they usher you into a kind of Eden, you write.
Right. What I was exploring, the word paradise itself mm-hmm. comes from the Greek and the Hebrew paradisos, mm-hmm. and it means a fenced place. And in almost every paradise myth, a fence place is a place where there's abundant, friendly animals. And what was interesting, what I discovered in the course of writing this book, was at the root of the word paradise is this, there's this Indo-European root word, day, D-E-I-G-H, mm. day, which means to knead or to milk, or a dairy. It's where our word dairy comes from. So at the very center of this notion of paradise is this idea of milking or kneading, in terms of kneading bread.
With a K. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it comes back to this idea of dairy and a fenced place where animals are milked.
And through that, right on into this intimacy. I mean, you it's not long before I don't know if you're anthropomorphizing the goats or just recognizing them for what they are and our kind of human connection with them, but within no time at all, they are not entirely the other.
Right. Well, that's what happens when you live. I mean, you know, the other is anything that's not us. So anything that's not us at first, you know, including humans, a certain, you know, human group, like all white people are like this or all Asians, you know, we can't distinguish. And it's just, it happens with animals. There's a herd of cows. There's a herd of goats, and they're indistinguishable. They're just goats.
From afar.
From afar. And then you start to live closely and you realize, well, no, they're actually individuals with individual desires and individual personalities and characteristics.
And hierarchy.
Oh, and completely a hierarchy. So, and, well, you probably know this from your sheep. I mean, they all probably had, there was the queen and the...
Absolutely, always. Each had a character. Give us the character of your first four, the characters.
Well, we had Hannah, who was the herd queen, mm-hmm. the golden goat. She was sort of gold. She looked like the golden calf, except she was a goat. Mm-hmm. And she was the herd queen. And then we had Lizzie, who... We don't keep a buck. We don't keep a male goat on the farm.
Too much trouble, too much danger.
No.
Well, if the wrong season, they'll knock you down and take
well,
you out.
Well, that too, but it actually comes down to the odor.
There's that about goats. Sorry, as a sheep guy, I have to say, yes, yeah. they can really smell.
I mean, the female goats don't smell at all. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing that smells is the male goat, and they only smell during rut, which is when mm-hmm. they're sexually active in the fall. So that smell we associate with goat cheese comes from the male, generally. And we didn't want that smell in our cheese. Mm-hmm. We didn't want it around the house, so we decided to not keep a resident male, but mm-hmm. take our girls to their date with the buck.
Yeah, they were sweet girls.
Yeah. So anyhow, Lizzie, who was she sort of in the absence of a male, she kind of took on the role of the buck, mm-hmm. and she was very watchful and protective and.
Got first whack at all the best food.
Well, yeah, Hannah the queen would get the first whack.
Oh, and Lizzie ringing up the rear. That's right. You
Lizzie
said
would
go
bring
almost
up the
rear. Bones to
yeah.
watch out for the rest.
She would watch out, and if the dog, you know, we have a dog, and if the dog got near the herd, she mm-hmm. would, you know, rear and strike the dog. So, and then everything in between, you know, the class clown, the runt, you know, the shy one. You know, we call one the locksmith because she's always getting out of things and playing with locks and, right. yeah.
Goats are pretty good at that. You're bringing the goat lovers out of the woodwork here. Deanna, in Fairfield, Vermont, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I just wanted to let you know how much I appreciate the show and share that I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s, into the 70s on a goat farm. We called it a subsistence farm in central Vermont with about 25 goats. And my job as a kid was to herd the goats and stay out in the field with them so that they wouldn't run back and eat my mother's flowers. But all the personalities that you're talking about, I used to love and reminisce fondly about. I actually did raise goats a little bit as an adult in recent years after moving back to Vermont. But now that my kids are grown, I'm back in the workforce full time and find I don't have the time to do it. But I may just get back into it. You're kind of making me feel like I really should be doing that. So
a little goat nostalgia. Deanna, thank you very much for that. And let me get one more right here from Shrewsbury, Vermont. Martha, you're on the air with Brad Kessler.
Thank you. I simply want to say I really loved the book, and I particularly the historical references and your interest in giving us a history of the words. I really enjoyed that. I also am an urban exile who has raised goats and tuna sheep, alpines, sonnens, and Nubians, and I reminisced with so many of your experiences taking them for a walk. We had Madam and you had Hannah, and it was really terrific. So I just want also it is having started with goats. 20 years ago when books were coming out, Real Vermonters Don't Milk Goats.
Right, of course.
How different the scene has changed.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. We have neighbors who, the Lawrences, who have Polly Meadows Farm in Shaftesbury, Vermont, who are, I think, third-generation dairy farmers, and they've had jerseys all, you know, of those other generations. And just about 5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago, they sold their jerseys, and now, guess what? They have goats. So Real Vermonters are starting to milk goats.
Yeah, that's great. Martha, thank you very much for your call. We've got to get a little bit, as you said, the milking doesn't happen without the sex, and the descriptions here, I mean, they took me back in the mind of Tom Wolfe in Man in Full, that amazing stallion and mare breeding scene. But you're, I mean, this is vivid stuff, and you remind us, whether it's in the breeding or in the poetry, Emerson saying that the goat god was the soul of all things. Keats called the goat, the buck, I guess, the dread opener of the mysterious doors leading to universal knowledge. Coleridge saw intelligence blended with a darker power more universal than the conscious intellect of man. I don't know if you can sew goat sex and that kind of poetic right. philosophy together, but give us a shot.
Well, here it is. Pan. They're referring to Pan, the goat god, who mm-hmm. is a Greek god that predates the Olympian god. So he's older than, you know, Zeus and Helen and all the rest.
Half man, half goat.
So he's this ancient horn god. And it turns out that horn gods go back all the way to, you know, Sumer and Mesopotamia.
Lecherous, avuncular, chased the nymphs, drank booze, caused mayhem.
Right. Now, that's Pan, who was a local Arcadian god. But he refers back to an actual earlier god that that could be, one of the Mesopotamian gods mm-hmm. or one of the mm-hmm. Egyptian gods that were the horn gods. Pan comes from the Greek meaning paon, which means the grazer, mm-hmm. but it also refers to Pan meaning all. So over time, there was confusion about what his name actually meant, and so he became two things. He became the grazer, just a goat, but he also became this mystical god who embraces all, so sex including.
And of all the Greek gods, you remind us, Pan alone is said to have died.
Right. What happened is with the horn gods is monotheism came into play, and you have the Old Testament where there's passages railing against the satyrs. We have people who worship the satyrs, and of course you have the golden calf, another horn god. And so the early Hebrews said, no, these are not real gods. And that theme got picked up then with Christianity and Christ's sermon and, you know, in Matthew where he says, put the sheep on my right and the goats on my left, and the sheep will inherit the kingdom of heaven and the goats will be damned to eternal flames.
The meek and mild here, the randy over right. here, and in time you remind us the god of the old religion became the devil of the new. Hoof, horn, tail, genitals intact.
Right. So part of the reason why goats are so scapegoated, not to use an obvious pun, is that and part of the reason why people always ask us, well, goats, isn't there something devilish about them, or isn't there something... All of this is the mythology. All of this is the stories that we tell ourselves. And the stories that we've been telling ourselves is that that the horn god, Pan, Cernunnos, all these horn gods were associated with the devil or with satyrs, and that sheep are good and goats are bad.
Hey, but I don't know, but your buck in full regalia, ready to go, is one randy sort of challengingly natural creature.
He's a natural god. I mean,
oh my gosh. Yeah. You took the does to be bred at a neighbor's, and what an afternoon.
Yeah, you know, they go into rut around late summer, and for about 5 months they're kind of sex addicts, and their testosterone drives them crazy, and they just want to breed everything.
They do. That was pretty wild. Did it finally? I mean, you're not exactly. I mean, you're beyond a city boy, but that's challenging. I would think.
Oh, I found it incredibly entertaining because it seemed like a paradigm of male sexuality, whether it was a goat or a human. If humans only could, or if they were given the license, they would all be like goats. That is, you know, males.
They will go after anything, anyhow. With talk about shameless. I mean, right. It doesn't even begin to enter the picture.
Well, it reminded me of a frat party. I mean, that's how the male goats were interacting. And, you know, there almost should have been a keg of Budweiser somewhere.
maybe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about, of all things, life with goats, with a writer who packed it in, moved to Vermont, and became a small-scale goat herd and cheesemaker. Brad Kessler is here. His new book is Goat Song, an absolutely beautiful meditation on a pastoral life. He joins me in the studio. There is goat cheese before us, and we're going to have it momentarily. But I want a little, if you'd read just a little first, there's a chapter called Terroir, as in the word we use for the sort of geography and minerals and everything else that goes into wine. You use it for cheese and goat cheese, and you open it with something from the Bible, the Old Testament, Proverbs 27, there will be enough goat's milk for your food, for the food of your household, and maintenance for your maidens. I love that. Would you read for us?
Sure. That summer I made cheese every other day. Mostly I made chèv and sprinkled it with chives or summer savory or sometimes lavender blooms. Sometimes I'd roll a cake in ground pepper or, unsalted, mix the curds with cranberries and walnuts. In spring, we ate chèvre with wilted watercress or dandelion greens, or a dollop on top of fried eggs and asparagus. In summer, we ate chèvre on grilled eggplant and zucchini and pasta or with black beans, salsa, and chips. We ate faisselle with woodland berries soaked in maple syrup or with peach slices when they came into season. Our chèvre had little resemblance to the goat cheese one finds in a store. Mass-produced chèvre, wrapped in plastic or vacuum-sealed, often comes from previously frozen curds or even powdered milk, and the milk is always pasteurized. Our chèvre had as much in common with store-bought as a sun-ripened tomato plucked from a vine in August resembles one grown under lights in February. No supermarket can get around the simple truth, says cheese expert Patrick Rantz, that goat cheese is a seasonal joy. I made mozzarella too that first year. The cheese was firm and salted and slightly piquant, good for slicing, melting, or grilling on pizza. All summer, breakfast was toast and thick slices of mozzarella. In August, we lived out of the garden, tomatoes, basil, beans, fennel, and mozzarella from the goats. There was enough goat's milk for our food.
Brad Kessler reading from Goat Song. I know how I love that. A dollop on top of fried eggs and asparagus. And then I made mozzarella too that first year. Hemingway writes cheese in Vermont. We've got the cheese right on the table before us. We've got to taste it. What do we have here? There's okay. One hard and one soft.
Right. We have a chèvre, a little cake of chèvre that's about 4 days old.
Paint a
four
picture
days.
Of it for
well,
us.
Well, 4 days from when the goat was milked. It's a little creamy, cylindrical, about 2 inches high, and it's basically like a creme fraiche almost.
And rolled in chives.
Yeah, these are just chives. One of them, usually, you know, I'll roll it in different things. This one was chives that were cut up this morning, and it was rolled in salt and chives. And the other one is a tome, which is something that I learned to make later on.
Define a tome for us.
Sorry, T-O-M-M-E in French means a volume, but it also refers to cheese. And historically, it's a mountain cheese made on a small mountain farmstead.
Hard cheese?
Hard cheese.
In a round.
It's round. It's about 10 inches round, and it ages anywhere from, you could eat it in 3 weeks, but it tastes best at 4 months. And then continues to age and gets wonderfully complex, 6 months, 7 months, even up to a year. It tastes like an Asiago.
Are we going to try these? I feel like the goats are in the room with us here.
Now, that's the...
you have to say yes.
Somewhat... that's unpasteurized chèvre, so that you're eating moonshine.
At my own risk. You describe it as moonshine. Right. It can't be bought or sold.
You cannot buy or sell that because you can't buy or sell a... raw milk, unpasteurized cheese that hasn't been aged for more than 60 days. So we don't buy or we don't sell that.
I'm going to the moonshine. The chives are fully in my nose. You get a little sprig of lavender alongside.
Is your lawyer
it's
here?
Gorgeous. Now, who needs it? What am I going to taste here from your pasture?
You're going to taste different hints of. Well, you tell me.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm going to try it first, of course, because they're all over the outside. Lovely salt to it.
Right.
And then, grass first.
Right, it's grassy.
And I don't know what to say beyond. There's a sweetness in there. Mm-hmm. I don't have the vocabulary.
Well,
cheese tasting.
Do you taste goat though? This is this thing that people try this cheese and they think, well, this doesn't taste like goat cheese.
No, I wouldn't. You know, the stereotype is somehow it's, I don't know, gamey.
It's got that piquant, peppery, hot taste. And
I wouldn't. I'm not sure I'd know this was a goat cheese, to tell you the truth.
Right. Well, that's what happened
with your story.
Yeah, that's what we discovered too.
Have another bite of
that. And that's why we decided to do this was that. If you don't keep a male on your farm, or even if you keep males, I mean, there's plenty of very good dairies, I mean, especially in Vermont and elsewhere, Wisconsin, California, that produce a cheese like this.
Oh my gosh, that is delicious.
But the freshness and the fact that it's unpasteurized creates those herbal notes.
And that whole vividness of it. I mean, it's not like Pecorino sheep cheese. I can kind of taste the sheep there.
Right.
But then... Well, let's go to the hard one, and maybe we'll have a different...
I mean, there's There's a different cheese for every occasion.
Of course. And this is the tome. And what about the flavor of this compared to your Chèvre?
Well,
it's hard.
It's hard.
But not a very, very hard cheese, just sort of medium density.
And that is...
tangy because it's aged.
Yeah. And it will continue to get complex. It's ripened from the surface inward by different, you know, molds that grow on it, which inform the cheese.
In the cellar of your house in Vermont.
In the cellar, technically our cave.
Your cave, yes.
So it's just our cellar, but yes. it's been code, you know, up to code in terms of...
Absolutely. Yes, I read all that. So I eat with confidence, but that's absolutely delicious. Now, how long was this aged?
This is only about a little more than 2 months. So this is legal. Mm. You're eating legal cheese.
And wonderful. My gosh. Savannah, Georgia. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've got just a quick comment. I enjoyed the discussion about the goats, but my experience with them has been a little mixed. My wife was very interested in goat cheese and wanted to make some herself, and so I told her rather than going and buying some goats, let's go to the Humane Society, which we did when we lived in Northwest Mississippi, and we had a couple of goats there, and we brought them home and turned them loose, and they stayed with us for about 9 months, but we could never get within 30 yards of them.
they weren't warmed up enough to humans.
I don't know, but we couldn't get within 30 yards of them, and they stayed around the house. They ate every bush, every rose, everything we had. They would stand on their hind legs and look in the window. So it was an interesting experience, but needless to say, we didn't get any cheese. So if you've got any suggestions, I'd like to hear.
Sure.
Them.
Not a bit of cheese. Yeah. Thanks, Joe. Brett?
Well, it helps having goats that were raised by humans that were handled a lot. I mean, all our goats were bottle raised, so they associate humans with a family member and particularly their mother. So they're incredibly friendly. I mean, they're more like pets than a farm animal. We take them for walks in the woods and they follow. We could call them. They know their names. They will come when they want to come. And so if you get some goats that are some newborns that have been around humans and that have been handled a lot, your experience will be completely different.
And you'll be closer to them, but you'll still be just handling them is a long way from having the cheese in hand. I mean, this is a lot of work. There's a daily ritual of milking. There's a lot you had to learn along the way here before this wonderful product.
Right, yeah. There is a lot of husbandry involved, and that was a learning process.
Learning, getting close to the goats. Venice, Florida. Todd, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just wanted to comment that, you know, when I was a youngster, I used to raise sheep. I didn't ever raise goats, but had the experience of kind of being a shepherd. You know, as growing older, I appreciate the fact of the reference to the shepherd in the Bible all the time. The fact that God is our shepherd. The Lord is our shepherd. The Lamb's Book of Life, where your name will be written.
There's a lot of it all through the Bible and many other sacred texts. And Brad traces that. If you'll let me, Todd, let me hold that right there and get another. Luke, no less, from Newbury, Vermont, maybe on this theme as well. Luke, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, I have a similar call question in regard, which is it seems like the obvious theme there is this sense of stewardship and connectedness, and often what grows from that is a sense of community, community with one's animals and community, you know, with other humans. And I was wondering if part of that were some of the considerations that motivated the author's move in the first place from New York.
I don't think it was a conscious decision. I think that, we didn't move from New York expecting to raise goats. Things just happened. And that was one of the wonderful discoveries along the way once we did get the goats, was this communion. I mean, literally there is a communion that goes on with the animals and through them with the earth. And I think you're exactly right about this idea of companionship and company and pasture. And incidentally, all those words come from this Indo-European root word, pa, which means to protect and to feed. And those are all the words related to pastoralism.
And not only the animals and the earth, but very vividly, and this took me back to childhood as well, to the human society around you, particularly through making hay, one of the most glorious times of my youth, Loved it, loved it, loved it. Every summer, very hard work, but in the company, kind of a communal undertaking,
right.
A very kind of delicate dance with earth and sky
and weather
and alfalfa or timothy, whatever you're making.
Yeah.
Hard work, and at the end of it, such satisfaction and a real community that produces something that sort of completes this triangle with the goats or sheep or whatever you're feeding. Talk about finding community. If you don't find it baling hay, I don't know where you will.
Right. I mean, and this was a revelation to me also. When I was, we lived in West Virginia for, it's where we sort of learned to live rurally. And we lived there, we rented a cabin for several years. And that was the first time I put up hay, well, they call it put up hay in the South, and they call it getting in the hay in Vermont. You know, I never, as a suburbanite, I never really understood what hay was. I mean, I knew there was hay. I knew that, well, horses ate it probably. But I never understood the connection, the direct connection between everything we eat, you know, that you know, our meat and our cheese and our milk comes from grass. And so in the book, I quote a lot of Whitman on Leaves of Grass, and I talk about grass. And, you know, putting up hay in West Virginia, there was, you know, when you need a lot of people to help. I mean, historically, you needed a whole community, less so in North America with, you know, mechanized. So since the war, World War II, you know, with mechanization, you know, you could do it with maybe a couple of people. But still in our valley and our neighbors, I was just doing it the other day. You know, you need, when the weather's right and there's hay to be made, everybody has to kind of pitch in. And that still exists in many rural communities throughout this country.
And it's hard and it's hot and you're up in the haymow till, you know, in all that dust till your snot turns black. And at the end of the day, what a great, great feeling.
Well, this feeling of satisfaction that you got it in and it didn't rain.
Yeah. Jeffrey in Framingham, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Jeffrey.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Hello to the author.
Yeah.
I really love goats. I only had raised one goat when I was living in New Mexico on a mountain, and we traded for a goat whose name was Polly, and tried to milk her 3-4 days, no milk. And my friend was saying, if we don't get any milk, we're going to have to perhaps eat her. And while he was saying it, I noticed that she was looking at us and twitching her ears and looking about, and suddenly milk started coming.
Come on. The heavens opened.
He's got a goat.
Right.
We both were certain that she could understand exactly what we were saying. We did milk her, and she was wonderful and very, I think she was an alpine goat. And at times she would run off with the dogs, and they would just run around the fields and halfway up the mountain. And it reminded me of what you were saying about the, how goats at times during their rutting season get very randy. I don't know if this applies also to females.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, they've got their moment. They've got their time. The only time that buck's going to be allowed near, but certainly, that, especially around milking, it's a very intimate connection. It's as though they're reading you. You finally took your cheese down to a New York restaurant, and we won't read it, but give us a sense of what that was like. This was a really classy place in New York, and you sort of humbly bring your little cheeses from the little operation for them to taste. Give us a sense of how that unfolded.
Well, you were saying you don't have the language for cheese, and neither do I. I mean, I
they sort sure of, did.
Well, I guess I do through the book.
Yes,
but
do.
Initially, I didn't, because you know, when language approaches something that's as pre-verbal and as elemental as food, it does some interesting things, hence the language of wine.
Mm-hmm.
When people talk about it, it's somewhat comical. The same thing with cheese. So I wanted to get a sense of what our cheese tasted like, because everyone that tried, this is our tome, not our chev, and everyone that tried it said, oh, it tastes great. It tastes just like a cheese I once had in Spain. Oh, it tastes just like a cheese I once had in France. And I said, well, what is that like? And they couldn't, they had no language for it. So there's this restaurant called Artisanal in New York City that specializes in handcrafted cheeses from around the world. And we brought our cheese down and had the cheese manager, you know, reluctantly, I think at first, saw this thing in a bag.
Yeah.
And thought, but then once they opened it, they realized it looked beautiful. It looked right. And they tried it and they thought, this is, they said, this tastes great. And not only does it taste great, but we would like to carry it if you get licensed.
Let me read the note that they gave you. To describe your cheese, this is after, which I enjoyed very much. This is from Sean Faith. I would say it has a nutty aroma. The palate is slightly eggy on the attack, followed by grassy and herbaceous notes with a touch of white pepper spice and undertone reminiscent of olives. These savory flavors meld beautifully with buttery notes of sweet cream, followed by a hint of salt and mild goaty notes. That's what I intended to say, Brad. The texture is yielding and slightly crumbly, and the finish is long and savory. Wow.
I love you've arrived,
baby.
Yes, eggy on the attack. That's what I want.
I want to go out with just a little crazy sound. You've got to remind us of how long and deep this relationship is. You mentioned in the book, this is the sound of women herders of Sweden using a melancholy melody known as cooning to call their goats. We'll hear a little bit of it as we go. Do you coon in the mountains?
We learn from these women.
Do you do this?
Well, we sing to our goats, and, well, my voice is not as good as this.
But you call them, and they
come. Call them, and they respond.
Brad Kessler's new book is Goat Song, A Seasonal Life, A Short History of Herding, The Art of Making Cheese. It is a wondrous little miracle of a book that brings us a wonderful experience. And I'm so grateful to you for sharing your cheese and your experience with us today. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been wonderful.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.